Welcome to episode 121 of the Actual Astronomy Podcast. I'm Chris, and joining me is Shane. And joining us this week are our guests, Randall and Clark. We are all amateur astronomers who love looking up at the nighttime sky. And this podcast is for anyone else who likes going out under the stars. Welcome, Randall and Clark.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Randall. Hey, Clark. All right. So what we'll do is maybe I'll just give a very short introduction to both of you in no particular order. So Clark is our National History Chair for the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, and Randall is the past National History Chair for the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, and I've sat under both of them just on the committee as. Mostly as an observer on the committee, both in the truest sense of the word. This is probably one of the most official dialogues that we've had, I think. So anyway, welcome to the show, guys. So Clark, you and I met when I moved to Ontario back several years ago, and we did quite a bit of observing together. I mean, I don't know if you remember any of the observing that we did during those times, but I don't know if you had any sort of observations or sessions that stick out in your mind.
Yeah, we did quite a few. I will say I recall that you at that time you had a fairly modest refractor, and I remember pointing out to you that, you know, in a dark sky and with some experience, you can really observe a lot of stuff through it. But I can't remember what that scope was.
Yeah, that was a little 80 millimeter William Optics triplet. F7, yeah.
Yeah. And that was, so that gave good views, and even though it was relatively small with someone who knew what they were doing, you could really hunt down some challenging stuff.
Yeah.
But I remember I had the 8-inch that I built for, and I used that for a while, the Dobsonian, classic San Francisco sidewalk back in the 90s, and I still had it at that time.
Yeah.
And we would go out with small groups of people, and I remember hunting down a supernova in Ursa Major, and we saw the zodiacal light out at the Moncton site, and we've observed with friends like Tim and Mike and so forth. So there's been quite a few in that few years.
Yeah, you know, my fondest memory of that telescope, I first looked through it, and I don't know if you recall this, but I think we met at some of the meetings and whatever. Then we started observing together, and we were up on Dance Hill. And I think you had it pointed at, it was either M53 or M3. I think maybe it was M3. It was globular cluster up near Boots. And we were on that Dance Hill site down in Cambridge.
Yeah, just near air. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. That was, the club had an observatory near air, Ontario, which had to be abandoned for a couple of reasons, but. One of them being the light pollution was encroaching anyways.
Yeah. And then my other memory of that telescope, I have a very clear memory of the early demise of that telescope, which was we were observing up in the Bruce Peninsula. It's a dark sky preserve up there, I think, isn't it?
Yes. Parts of that area is definitely, yes.
And you had that telescope set up. And I remember we were all sitting around. And there was an electrical storm coming in, and I was still getting used to those because I'm from the East Coast, where we don't get really severe thunder and lightning storms. They're uncommon there anyway. And I remember I was really nervous, and I packed up all my stuff. And I don't want to say you guys were making fun of me, but you guys left your gear out. I'll put it that way.
Way real men do.
Yeah, you'll remember... a woman named Kate, and she had similar problems with her telescope, and essentially, I mean, the lightning was ferocious and terrifying, man. Although my lens was okay, the objective, the mirror, the base got soaked, and the fiberboard basically expanded with the water in it, so I had to have it fixed. It wasn't that difficult a thing to do, but that was quite a weekend.
Yeah, your 8-inch went from light bucket to water bucket.
Yeah, yeah,
classic Beckett. Clark, How much of that instrument did you make? I assume you did the whole OTA thing and the bass.
Yeah, now, again, I started this in the 90s, and I needed help. Mm-hmm. Somebody went to, I believe, New Jersey and picked up a whole bunch of blanks. There was about...
That'd be from Edmund Scientific, probably.
I'm not 100% sure, to be honest, but it might well have been. But you needed an 8-inch blank and an 8-inch tool.
Yeah.
And so he must have had about 15 or 16 of these, and people picked them up. And the rest of it I got from the San Francisco Sidewalk Astronomers website.
Oh, very nice. So you ground your own mirror?
Yes, I did.
Excellent.
And in those days, the internet was in its infancy, so you're just using simple tools. But a gentleman of the club who had made his own managed to get me the grit that I needed and all of that stuff, polishing stuff. And I sent it off to Sudbury, to Alan, who was working even then. He's still around.
Yeah.
And he coded it. But by today's standard, it's pretty primitive. That being said, error was good. Gave great use.
That's what counts. That's the thing that counts.
That was probably Corning. Okay? I think that was Corning because they're out of New York.
No, I think Corning are in New York.
Could be, but I think they sold their brains at a place.
Edmund Scientific is in Barrington, New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
This was in probably 1992 or something, 93.
Doesn't matter. But that means Clark has had plastic experience of amateurs, so many amateurs, from the 20s up until, I guess, the Schmidt, Schmidt-Cass revolution. If you wanted an instrument, they were so goddamn expensive, you had to make your own.
Yeah.
And fewer of us had that experience, but Clark had it, which is really cool.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, that is super cool. You know, I think the ATM movement or the amateur telescope maker movement has sort of evolved into, you know, buying a mirror that's already done and really just like putting it together in a cell and then a lower tube assembly or whatever it may look like, but to actually like grind a lens or grind a mirror. I don't hear too many stories of that anymore, and that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, Shane's right. A lot of people will make the structure now, but buy the focuser and buy the optics. Yeah.
It was part of the because it was the first time it said you should build an 8-inch, specifically 8-inch aperture.
Jean Tixereau. That's right.
Yeah, the 6, it's not much more work than a 6, but the 10-inch would be a lot more work, a lot more grinding. Mm-hmm. And it even recommended a specific focal length. And at the time, because I was new, wasn't sure why, but I just did it. And now I, having used
it. Was it F8?
Yeah, F7.
F7.
And the reason that in an 8-inch, like if an F10 would be a little longer tube, and I'm not.
That's right.
I'm about 6 foot, so that wouldn't work. Uh-huh. And it's not that much harder to figure an F7 versus an F10. And it still had, it was fairly easy to collimate. When I eventually purchased an F5 scope, although it was 12 inch, much harder to collimate, the focusing is harder. So, and in those days, it's probably less a problem now. Those little things mattered. And I began to understand as I used it that this was a very functional focal length for beginners. And telescope making. The other thing was it was long enough for planets and focal length, mm-hmm. and short enough for deep sky and told all that. Now, keep in mind the eyepieces in those days weren't as wide field as they are now either. Mm-hmm. But it was a very satisfying telescope.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. How many hours, Clark, would you have put into that mirror?
Well, I'm afraid to even think about it because... I had half ground it. And then it sat for 2 years. I moved, and the damn thing sat for another 2 years, and I picked it up again. So in that sense, the work was uninterrupted, but it was a lot. I polished the crap out of it and got a really... so it was easily 100 hours. But again, it took time because, you know, a friend of mine, was encouraging me, got me the grit, and took time to get the finer grit and so forth. And all of this was done. You used what, for the most part, was the W stroke, and it was all on on sheets of paper that had been printed out of a book. I can't even remember which book it was that this friend, I think, Chris, you know, Jeff, you know, I'm talking. He gave me the grit and the instructions as to how to do the W stroke. And I even had a little blue plastic barrel and in the basement and doing all that.
That's excellent.
Wow. So Clark, is it similar to, can't talk. Is it similar to woodworking where you start with like a more coarse grit and work your way up to an extremely fine grit, or is it just the same grit through the entire process?
I mean, well, the grinding is you get finer and finer until you get to a polish, right?
Right, right.
You're sort of, if I recall, you're using a grit, and then when you see that it's not improving in surface smoothness, you go to the next one.
Right.
And then, of course, you had to clean it, because if you had a larger piece of grit with the finer stuff, you'd scratch it again. So that was part of the process, too. I think you just, you know, it said so many minutes or so many hours on this grit, you should go down to the next one that's finer and so forth and so on.
Wow. I'm really fascinated by this. You know, it's sort of been a fantasy of mine to maybe one day make this a project where I make my own telescope, but like right from the ground up, and there's nothing that would be prefab. I know nothing about it. It's just been sort of a fantasy of mine. So hearing your story of it is awesome. Like, it, you know, it's neat to hear firsthand what is required and you know, what you had to go through to accomplish it. Were there any setbacks along the way or any sort of lessons learned?
Well, yeah, I think when it came to figuring the mirror and testing the optics, that's where I needed help. Use the, is it called the Ronchi grating?
Oh, yes.
Things like that, I needed a little bit of help. And again, the internet was in its infancy, so it's not easy to get your hands in this material. You really need to rely on those amateurs who were going to help you and you know, get you the some of that equipment and help with that. I know there's amateur telescope makers in Kitchener, Waterloo, where I live, that are making, you know, they're faster than F3 and they're 20 inches. And some of them are, you know, even designing critical parts they need on 3D printers and stuff. So it's a completely brand new ball game, and it's out of my league, frankly.
Yeah, the 3D printing. Oh, sorry, Randall. I was just going to say the 3D printing really, I think, opens up the, you know, the modification or you know, forming your, you know, unique telescope components. It's a pretty cool technology. We had Justin Wasner on here many episodes ago, who's really into 3D printing, and it blew my mind, you know, the projects that are available for amateur astronomers. But, you know, that's, I suppose that's another topic altogether.
Even Chris has had some experience in that.
Well, yeah, I was gonna jump in and say that there's a bit of a segue here to Randall with that, because, and people have heard us talk about these 3D printed binoculars that Shane really coordinated making for us, but Randall was the one that sent us the template and the photos of his 3D printed binoculars that he had made up. And that really inspired us to actually make our own. So, you know, kind of sort of officially, thank you for sending those to us, Randall.
Well, I didn't originate those. The person who drew those, I guess it was a computer-aided drawing, was a guy who made them freely available. Someone in Europe, but he made them freely available on cloudy nights. And I'm very grateful he did. Yeah, they're fantastic.
Yeah, I'll tell you, though, what made it real and what made it happen for us is that you would kind of work through a couple, like I had read them, had read about them on Clyde and Nights, and I'd seen people's results, but everybody seemed to have a bit of a different take. And because here we are in Canada, I think some of the parts in that, there was a couple things that were a little different, and I'm not a very handy person, and I couldn't quite sort it out. I was just never going to do it, right?
Well, yeah, I sent you the parts list and stuff.
That's right. You sent me the parts list that you had been able to obtain here. So I just went, this is brilliant. Still a little bit out of my league, but I'm like, Shane is the handyman. He's going to be able to sort this out. So we pooled our resources, and within a few months, we each had a...
I mean, there is a connection between the sort of high-tech stuff, stuff that appears to us to be cutting edge. I mean, you can print this stuff in all types of different materials. It seems, it almost seems like something out of science fiction. You know, it's hypernova computer, and out it comes. It's not quite that yet, but it's pretty damn close. Yeah. He ordered online. I mean, this would have been inconceivable a decade
ago
as a reality. But there's a connection between that and the ATM movement at its beginning, because even back then, they would use whatever, if you had access to a really up-to-date machine shop and the latest techniques, say around 1927, you'd use that. Could.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, cannibalizing stuff. You could turn to astronomical use. The ATM movement never entirely died away, fortunately. And there's still usually people in each center, amateur astronomy, who do this stuff. And that's sort of the Jerusalem of the ATM's movement still exists in Vermont, Stalafane, and that's still quite active. You mentioned Peter earlier. Peter goes down there quite often. So is Alan Ward.
Yeah.
Alan has 3D printed all the parts for one of his refractors.
Yeah.
I think it was a Petzval refractor. He 3D printed everything but the optics.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's amazing. So Randall, you and I have sort of this little bit of a strange coincidence in how we sort of struck up a conversation one day. I don't know if you mind me kind of going into that a little bit.
We were at, it was the first of the RASC General Assemblies I'd ever attended. I forget what the year was, 2008 or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be about right.
And there was Chris. And I don't know, is there a polite way of saying this? There are a lot of people there whose enthusiasm went beyond their skill. You know that happens. If someone's humble about it, that ain't a problem. That applies to all of us. But if not, that is a problem. And I was getting tired of this sort of thing. And there is this, and this was held at the Science Center in Toronto. And it's not a brilliantly designed building. There are problems with a lot of extraneous noise. So I was just, I think I was looking for a place that was quiet and we were passing each other. And we struck up conversation. So it turns out, where Chris is from, the place where he's born and he grew up, is what, a couple of miles from where my spouse's farm was, and near where Chris liked to observe. Complete, just pure chance.
It's very, very strange that we eventually sat down and we had to work it out, because we knew it was relatively close, but when you came to visit that time, we sat down in front of Google Earth and we actually sort of put the pins on the paper. I think it came out to maybe it was like 7 or 8 kilometers away where you had actually done your observing, and where I was, like, I had like picked an observing site to go observing at was maybe like a 3 or 4 minute drive away from where you were observing.
Anyways, from the beginning of talking to Chris, it was clear that talking to him, unlike talking to a lot of the other people, was not a waste of time. That was also a good thing.
Yeah. Well, we are amateur astronomers, and so that's what we like to do. So we've got this isn't even our topic. So this is just some preamble to our topics here today. So back a number of years ago, Clark had lent me a telescope. So I can't even remember why I had borrowed it from him, but he'd lent me something called it's basically like a Galileo telescope. Now, back during 2009, I actually went back and watched a video on this today. They had created these Galileo telescopes for purchase. You could buy them. They're made out of plastic. But unlike Galileo's telescopes, I think they were made with sort of modern lenses. And I think the size was a bit was
it was a two lens achromat.
Yeah.
There was a choice. I forget the design, but you had a choice in how you configured the eyepiece.
Yeah.
Either small field of view or a bigger one. The objective was really good on those things. I think it was a 50 millimeter, 2 inch objective.
Yeah.
I forget, what was it? F6, F7, maybe.
Something like that, yeah.
And it was fairly decent. They were selling them for 20 or 25 US at the time.
Yeah.
It was the American Astronomical Society, so that's the professionals, and it's their contribution, as Chris mentioned, to the international blowout year, IYA 2009, celebration 400 years since Galileo turned the telescope to the heavens. So the idea was, is there something we can make that's going to be inexpensive, make it in volume? Rick Feinberg was involved in a lot of the design of this. I used to be an editor at Sky and Telescope. Can we design something great volume? We could have it distributed because it's inexpensive. So you buy one, and I think there was an arrangement where if you bought one for yourself for a couple of bucks, you could also donate one.
Yeah.
To a place which wasn't, you know, the modern industrialized world, which is really attractive and a cool idea. And that was part of their idea behind building these things. They're sort of a quality small instrument.
Yeah.
That was inexpensive. Sorry, Chris.
And no, I was just gonna say, and so I was gonna get one, and then one of the things that I was a little bit disappointed in, although they're called the Galileo telescope, they were more in the spirit of Galileo and kind of putting a small telescope into the hand.
Exactly. It wasn't giving you the singlet objective lens that was stopped down. It wasn't grounded according to the 17th century formula. Didn't have the eyepiece, so it wouldn't really give you the experience of that.
No, and
I had the same disappointment.
And that probably is better for you know, sort of the masses, right? Like, that's probably better for people that are just looking to spend $20 on a telescope and actually have something to use. So I was always curious what Galileo would have actually seen through his telescope, and then Clark comes along with his version of this. So Clark, do you want to just give us? And we have a photo that we can tweet out. But do you want to give us a brief synopsis of the telescope that you created and in the keeping with what Galileo was?
Clark's is much closer to what someone in the early 17th century would have used. I'll shut up in a minute. And Clark's, even though he used the modern material, it looks very close to one of those early 17th century instruments. Really convincing.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm guessing that Galileo didn't use a central vacuum cleaner tube for his mouth. But the point of it was to make it optically similar. And it just so happened at that time, and they were doing this on the internet, Rice University, I believe, in Houston.
Oh, that's where Al Van Helden was.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've got his book in front of me right here. I ordered it. Remember, he translated Galileo's Sidereus Nuncius, I believe, to English with his own notes and so forth.
Yeah.
But anyways, it was fortuitous that Rice University was making a museum quality replica. Mm-hmm. Part of their process was measuring the lenses as accurately as possible. Now it is, I believe, there are only two in existence left. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the two that exist were the ones he were using when he was observing Jupiter's moons for the first time. But you get a same ballpark. So I was able to order lenses that they were like $5 or $10 a piece that Galileo used, or the specs were the same anyways. I was able to order those online at a place that sold, you know, tens of thousands of lenses. And so when they came in, I had the right focal lengths for the objective and the right focal length for the lens that I will describe as the eyepiece. And you put the two together. And the one instrument that I used most was about 14 magnification. And I could stop it down the aperture, which was what Galileo did anyways, stop it down with a piece of plastic, you know, that an orange, that the orange juice comes in, and drill a hole in it. So to get the aperture to about 25, 26 millimeters, in other words, about an inch.
Yep.
And then you put the one end, two different tubes that slide in together for focus. And what I found was the final product was very close to what Galileo used. And most critically, so you get the aperture by stopping it down, you get the focal length, you get the magnification. And very important is the field of view, because the field of view he had was terrible. And it ranged, according to Rice University, 15 to 18 minutes of arc, which is about a quarter degree. So when you're looking at the moon, you only get 1/4 of the full moon in the view.
And that puts what he did to do those full moon images in perspective. It's a real skill.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Hey, yeah, one more thing. Sorry, Clark. I'll do this.
Okay. The only thing where I was guessing is that I was putting it on a modern, I think I had a Manfrotto tripod, which would be used for any standard digital camera there, today.
You weren't too far off because that simple Aldazimus movement, it's speculated that what Galileo had would have been similar in the way it worked.
So I decided, well, with the Sidereus Nuncius book that Albert Van Helden had, we just talked about him, had translated, I took that and I started to observe Jupiter in the same manner that Galileo did in January of, I think it was 1610. And every night when it was dark, I looked at Jupiter once a night, and I was fortuitous because I did this in October of 2008. And I started to observe Jupiter every night using the telescope and sketching what I saw. And I got about 20 or so sketches in before the November clouds took over. And the most startling thing was the consistency at which I was seeing the moons compared to him. So his own records, he observed it for a lot longer. But I would suggest that about 25 to 30% of the time, he was seeing all four moons. And the reason he wouldn't see the moons is either because one of them or more of them was either right in front of the planet or right behind it. And certainly in a modern telescope or binoculars, you wouldn't see it in either of those, except when it's transiting. Part of that is if it was too close to the disk of the planet, he wouldn't have been able to see it either. The second reason he wouldn't see four is if two moons were too close together, they would appear as one. In a modern telescope, you would easily see two disks. And the third seems to have been error, where he just missed it. And so I compared it to my own, and I didn't do enough to get a statistical analysis, but I was only seeing four moons in about 13 or 14% of my drawings. So most of the time I'm seeing three. And this was consistent. And although I wanted to do it for longer, I was able to determine that the outer moon of Jupiter, which is Callisto, had about a 16 or 17 day period. And Galileo, one of Galileo's conclusions was that the outer moon was a bi-monthly period. So that's consistent. Someone mentioned, and rightly so, that, well, the lens you are using is going to be far superior to Galileo's. And that's true, I suppose. But it begs the question, why didn't I get better results than him if in fact, I'm using better lenses? I tried making the other one, and I did make the other one. It was higher magnification, about 20 or 21 power, but a smaller aperture. And it was the magnification, keep in mind the field of view is even smaller. It was almost impossible to use. I did look at Venus and I did see the crescent phase of Venus through it, but that's about all, only fleetingly. It was too difficult to use. So this gave me some insight as to what we was up against. And while I'm talking, I also tried to sketch the Pleiades as Galileo did in that same work in Sidereus Nuncius. And I quit because it was too difficult. And I just realized, well, keep in mind that the field of view is only a quarter degree, that the Pleiades might be a degree by a degree and a half, something like that. So that means it's about 30 fields of view wide or up at the X and Y axis. So that he got any results at all was remarkable. And I began to think that maybe, and I'm not an expert sketcher, but it would seem to me that he might have sketched the Pleiades naked eye in a fairly large piece of paper and then went using his telescope and filled in the smaller, the fainter stars. Because to do it, it's a little bit like if you're going to the Louvre in Paris and you're looking at the Mona Lisa through a drinking straw.
Yeah,
you can only see one small part of it. You think, okay, there's the mouth, and there's her arms, her fingers, and there's, it was tedious and very difficult, and frankly, not that rewarding. So it does bring, using this instrument, it does bring into question as to how he tried to draw even the moon, because it too is at least four or five fields of view, especially the full one. And I believe he tried to draw the stars in Orion and gave up on that. So
I'm just showing the images here. I don't want to cut anybody off, but I've got Clark's scope on the left, which is made, I think, like you said, out of a central piece of a central vacuum tube. And then on the right, an older photo of, and I know it's older because I've been there, photos of Galileo's, a couple of Galileo's telescopes. And now it doesn't say this anywhere here, but it actually probably says it in Latin or something down below.
Also in the middle there, Chris, you see that crystal that's cracked?
Yeah.
That's the lens that's thought to, now Roger strategically thinks that is the lens. That lens is authentic by Galileo, and that may have been used. I don't think Roger said, but some people think that may have been used. That may have been the instrument used when he made those discoveries.
Yeah, that's what it says there. Like when you and I can't recall if you've been to the Museum de Galileo.
I haven't, unfortunately.
Oh yeah. So now they don't have it mounted up like this. So the main thing that looks like a giant brooch is still there, and the glass is in it, and the glass is actually broken.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, inside there. And then
that whole display is like a monstrance or something. That was made by a craftsman, very good carver, in about the 1670s with Medici. Yep. We have a complete copy of everything, including the cracked lens, the Dorner Telescope Museum.
Oh, really?
Full size one. Yes. And the two telescopes. Unfortunately, they're non-working.
Yeah.
But copy that whole damn thing life size.
So the way they have it set up now is they don't have the telescopes like hooked into it like that. And they've kind of reconfigured this, unfortunately, because this, I think the original, and I could be wrong on this, you can correct me, but I think the original intent was to put this, as it's shown set up here, in the Tribuna di Galileo, which is over at La Spagola. And then as time
this is on, way older than the Tribune.
Oh, is it?
Oh yeah, this is centuries old. This was done in the same century that Galileo died. This was done, I give it 30 years Galileo died.
Okay.
But it was part of that. But the idea, you're right in one aspect, the idea to honor him, it's almost like part of doing a cult of Galileo.
Yeah.
That was the same thing. And that's why the Tribune was built.
Yeah.
And I think it's 19th century.
And this was there, but then when they moved it across, I guess they reconfigured all of these displays, which is kind of, I think it looks kind of cool with the telescopes in it, kind of unfortunate.
It does. But a funny thing about that is, of course, that's completely non-functional. You couldn't really observe that.
But no.
If you look at drawings and paintings of Galileo observing, or Galileo showing his new telescope to the people of Florence, or Galileo showing his telescope to the members of the Venetian Senate, they show him trying to observe through that, which is hilarious.
Yeah, because they're kind of stacked on top of each other, and you actually couldn't, you know, get to the eyepieces properly. It's high though. Like this thing, the actual thing they have there, like the pole that they're on, it's pretty high. But
oh yeah, it is. Yeah.
But the way that they're hooked into it is not.
It's just not. Of course, it was meant for a display.
Yeah, it's just
this whole idea. You've got these princely cabinets, curiosities, or private museums. I guess for the Medici one. One interesting thing, now Clark mentioned the narrow field of view. And of course, looking through a reconstruction, you get a real, as Clark said, you get a real respect for people who had to use these things. This most spectacular example I know is those fantastic and unbelievably accurate for their time engravings of the moon by Claude Melun. They were done in the 1630s in the south of France. He used telescope Galileo, the accuracy of the placement and the depiction of the lunar features is way, it looks like something out of the 19th century. It's that good. Well, he used one of these instruments with an incredibly narrow field of view. So somehow, as an artist, he had to stitch those together. And that's even more spectacular than what Galileo did.
Yeah, I'm just looking. I don't know if you can see it. I'm sharing my screen. I just called just like a random image up. Yeah, you can see a lot more detail on that. And then kind of hopping back over. So Actually, Clark, your image, I think, looks a little bit more like Claude Melan's than Galileo's. Like your features are a little bit more to scale on the moon.
Yeah, I think so. Clark, you published something on this, didn't you?
I believe, Randall, you were involved with the Galileo challenge back in 2009. You might be there. Just a brief page or two. Yeah. The thing I noted about visually when I tried to draw the moon, and again, more than one field, it's not artistically great, but it in Galileo's, you see a lot of weird markings in his sketch in the southern part of the moon, and it certainly showed up that way through the eyepiece of his.
Very rough, the highlands.
So the texture was right and things like that. But where I think he obviously went south was in some of those craters.
It's thought that he did that on purpose because his intention was to show that this was not a perfect sphere made up of stuff which you don't find on the Earth.
Right.
This fifth element stuff, that it was like the Earth. So he exaggerated by showing there's that one crater, right? Huge, that large one in the middle, one of those images. But that he wanted to show is this stuff's just rough. It's not the Aristotelian explanation. That's what you usually read in the literature, what is possible motivation. But it's interesting that you saw something like that, the roughness.
Yeah, definitely. And if I'd been a better drawer, there was probably a little more detail there than I was.
I thought yours was pretty good, though.
Huh? And of course, you're trying to draw while the moon's moving through the field, and you have to sort of there was no tracking, guys. I don't know when that was invented, but so it was a challenge, and I do want to, before I get too far removed in observing Jupiter, I read his notes quite regularly where they appeared to be brighter or dimmer from time to time. Some of that would be any moon seen near the disk of Jupiter would be fainter because of the glare. There's no question. But other times I determined that it was transparency that was causing it, although I don't believe Galileo ever figured that out. There were times where, all the moons are faint, and other times where they were quite bright. And I had interpreted that as being transparency in the sky. The sky is clear to the unaided eye. And I think we've all observed through telescopes like that where the sky looks good and it's the views are disappointing. So he was getting that, and I believe that's why.
Hmm.
And the only way you don't think of these things unless you try to observe with a similar telescope. And I would suggest that it's much easier to do with Galileo scope because the design's simple. Try doing it with Ross's scope, the 72-inch speculum mirror. Or even Newton's scope, which has got more than one reflective surface, it becomes much more difficult and sophisticated to try and know for sure that the equipment you're using is similar or identical. Mm-hmm.
The one thing I really noticed when I used the Galileo telescope that you built, Clark, in looking through it, and I think pretty much I only just observed Jupiter quite a few times, just like my property, is that the view of the planet itself, like the eyepiece, is very different, and it's almost like the view of Jupiter. It's like Jupiter or whatever planet I was looking at was like sitting inside the telescope, and then you would kind of look in and sort of be looking at like a projection somewhere, like sitting. It was very strange. It was just like sitting in there in the telescope. Did you notice that as well?
Yeah, a little bit. In other words, the focus is inside or something like that.
And classic that's it. Classic description of the Galilean lens.
If you
inside. Yeah.
If you moved your eye slightly, you could sort of peer. You move your eye to the right in the eyepiece, and you could sort of see more to the left, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
In the sky, so it was very strange.
That should happen. That should happen with those binoculars we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
They're actually, that's a Galilean arrangement. You should of course, the problem with them is much less power, but it's the same principle. So you might be able to get that same effect.
Yeah, I'll have to try it. I didn't notice that as much. And maybe, like you said, because the power's so low. But so I really had very low expectations of the Galileo telescope when I had it in my possession and was looking at, I think I looked at like Jupiter and Saturn. And, you know, I really thought that, you know, it would just sort of be this crappy image. And then, you know, I'd sort of be able to say, okay, well, you know, this is kind of what Galileo. So I just sort of want that experience. I didn't do drawings like Clark did at all. I couldn't imagine trying to do that. It must have just been like mind numbing to try to pan that around, like you described. But this business with the way that the images would sit inside of the telescope, I kept thinking about at the time, you know, when Galileo was showing people the images through his telescope, that just must have just really, really rattled people. Because even for me as an amateur astronomer, having looked through all kinds of optics over the years, looking and seeing, like you could kind of see it sort of floating there in the telescope when you moved your eye up. I mean, it kind of took me aback. Anyway, I just wanted to.
I suspect it would have been very difficult. I mean, you hear these stories where they were demonstrating the telescope to important figures, political leaders, I suppose, and what have you. And, you know, not everyone would have the skill to be able to use it. However, on terrestrial objects like a building or a chimney, or, you know, it was probably a little easier to do, especially in daylight. Mm-hmm. And an object that wasn't moving in it, you know, that kind of thing.
Now, I want to move across here to Randall, and you sent me these images, and they look right out of the Museum de Galileo. I mean, these are really, really cool. I think I only put a few of them in here. I think I'm missing some, but oh no, wait, they're down below. You
can't see it on the screen.
Yeah, basically, I'm going to describe it to people though. If your doorknob was wooden, this is what we're looking at. And it's got a hole in it, and it looks like there's a lens in it. What are we looking at here?
Give me a second here. So those two wooden doorknob things, that's a good description of them. They're hardwood. They've been turned. Those were turned on an antique lathe, actually, in Germany.
Hmm.
One of them is the cell for the objective lens, and one of them is a cell for the eyepiece. And what this is a reproduction of a mid-17th century, so this is a mid-17th century instrument. It's sort of the generation after Galileo. It's part of, so the Dorner Telescope Museum, and what the museum decided to do is have a reconstruction, the first known telescope used for the first known telescopic astronomical observation in Canada, of a reproduction of that instrument made. And what Chris has are pictures of that instrument being produced. It's not finished yet. So those are the lens cells. So, and this is an instrument used by a Jesuit, Father Bersani. This is in 1646. It was a lunar eclipse. He observed from Saint-Marie among the Hurons. And he was an interesting guy, but his observations were considered good enough by the best astronomers in Europe. They passed them around, they published them, and they said in print that the instrument Pierre Gassendi, famous philosopher, you know, atomist and famous astronomer of the period, who was a patron of Claude Melun, who did those lunar images, Galileoscope, earlier, but he said that Father Bersani used an exceptional telescope. So that means in the wilds of Canada, 1640s, the first astronomical observation we know of done with a telescope in Canada was done with a superior instrument. So what I did is I asked Roger Seragioli if he could make the lenses for this. And Roger's had experience in reproducing earlier optics, going right back to Galileo's day. Reproducing earlier optics using a technology that would have been done at the time. Roger made the lenses, and his friend, Walter Stefani, and his friend, Dr. Arne Payson, in Germany, are doing the OTA, That's what Chris has pictures of there. And the stand. So there's going to be a fully functioning reconstruction of what that instrument was probably like. Now, again, we've got surviving instruments from that period, like people like the Compani brothers, very famous at the time, but we don't, and their descriptions, we have the artifacts, we have descriptions, we have some observational drawings, but we don't have Bressani instruments. So this is the best guess, if you like, of what it would have been like. I'm trying to remember, I think it'd be F30 or F45. So it'd be a meter and a half long. So you're going to ask something, Chris?
Shane, do you have a question there, Shane?
What type of refractor was that, Randall?
It's basically the design that Kepler came up, which is a modification of Galileo. So it's a single, your objective lens is a single lens, biconvex. And the big development wasn't that. It wasn't the lens. It wasn't the objective lens. It was the eyepiece. And there was another priest around this time who came up with an eyepiece with a much bigger field of view. And I think, I'm trying to remember. It's a compound eyepiece, three elements, I think. So it's going to have one of those eyepieces. So it's just a refracting telescope with a single lens objective. So it's the next generation on from what Clark, which is that copy of the sort of instrument Galileo. And we'll be able to use this thing when it's done.
That's amazing. When do you think that will be done? Is that near term?
It should be. The optics are done. And Chris has got those pictures of the OTA being made and the lens cells. I imagine it'll be done this year.
Wow. That's amazing.
These guys are really good. You know, Roger and the people who are listening to us on this broadcast, you know, your listeners, you probably have stuff, optical stuff designed by Roger. You just don't know it. Roger works at the Stewart Observatory, the University of Arizona, the Mir Lab, famous Mir Lab. The people who are doing the mirrors for the giant Magellan telescope, that's where Roger works. But he also makes other things, you know, on the side. He's a professional optician. He just happens to have a doctorate in classics from Harvard. It's actually very funny. Roger's put that, you know, to good use because he's translated 17th century and 19th century books on optics, you know, from Latin, because he has the languages. I expect it to be ready earlier this year. The museum might arrange to take this around various centers, so people at the RAS centers at least get a view of the moon and say the Pleiades, you know, through this thing. It's done. And I've been told by Roger or Walter that you can actually get a full, the difference between this and the Galileo one is that this will give, is a field of view. You can get the whole moon, which makes life a lot easier.
Yeah, for sure.
It's also diffraction limited. A lot of people don't realize that a lot of the early instruments were that. And just a little extension on this, Alan Ward, so he's the optical expert in Sudbury, who Clark went to get his mirror silver or luminized. Alan wants to make another type of 17th century telescope. Talked about this. This is for the Dorner Museum. He wants to make a working model of one of those 17th century aerial telescopes. This is one of those things, I have, say, a 3 or 4 inch objective. Say, again, just a single lens objective with a focal length of 50 feet, that sort of. And there's no tube.
Yeah.
It's sort of out in the open. That's why they call it an aerial telescope. And you can control it with a wire. Apparently, there's incredible depth of field with these things. And also, more than one person would look through the instrument. You could have 3 or 4 people around this thing, each with a different eyepiece, looking through the instrument at the same time.
Huh.
Which is crazy.
That is. I can't even imagine that.
Apparently, this design, sort of design, I think one of the Huygens brothers, well, the discoveries made by the Huygens brothers and the very first Cassini, Giovanni Cassini, were with this sort of instrument. And now, if you look at popular books on astronomy, people often say, oh my God, how did anyone ever use one of those? It was so unwieldy. That's usually stated by people who've not had the experience of using them. They haven't done what Clark did and try to make a good, responsible reconstruction and then try to reproduce the observation. It didn't do that because clearly these things worked because discoveries were made with them. We have observational drawings. We've got observations in numerical form of these things. So it'd be really cool. Well, this will be cool in three respects. One is people will have this experience looking at this and using it, going back in time to a certain extent. It's cool because they'll have the experience of actually looking through this thing.
Is there anybody anywhere that has made a replica?
Yeah, there is. There is. There's two I can think of.
Okay.
The RASC member and professional planetary observer, Alduin Dolfus, was he was also a balloonist. He went up to the stratosphere to do observations, believe it or not, in the 50s. He's a professional astronomer. He worked at the Pic du Midi. He was a fantastic astrosketcher. But late in his life, his honorary RASC member, late in his life, he was part of a team that made a reconstruction of one of these in France. And I think there's at least one report about its use. And there's at least one group in Japan that made, so it's an astronomy club in Japan. They've made a reconstruction of one of these classic ones. And I think the one they made is, it could be 75 or 100 feet long, which is so cool. And you can actually, this was covered. There was a bunch of pictures in one of the Cloudy Nights forums about this and also elsewhere on the web. So there are people who actually tried to make these things.
We'll have to check that out.
We're just getting about to time there. I think Shane has a question for you.
A question for both of you guys, actually. You've mentioned recreating these views that the early astronomers had with, much different or much simpler instruments than what we're used to today. Some of the struggles that go with observing with those instruments. Now, after having looked through, say that like your scope, Clark, that you created the Galileo scope there, after using that for a period of time, did you feel that improved your observational skills, that when you went to, say, a more modern telescope, were you able to see a little bit more, or was it, negligible?
I think, to be honest, it was negligible. The Galileo scope is very simplistic. But it does help you, at least I was thrilled that I was getting results that Galileo did. So I must've been doing something right, I guess. you had to really, look at his notes carefully. And I was telling you about the what I think was the transparency issues those kind of things. Because if it isn't until you use the telescope, at least, and I think that's probably true for most of us, that it doesn't even come to your head the issues that they had. But it's not until you use it that you realize their challenges. So, as far as making me a better observer, I can't say that it did. Before we started this podcast, we were talking that Chris used a very modest piece of a telescope years ago when I met him. And in the right hands, a small instrument can do fantastic things. These are targets that I would have guessed that most people wouldn't have imagined would be rewarding. But in the right hands, they can do wonderful things.
Chris has pointed that out with those 60-millimeter tacks. They seem to perform way beyond what they should perform. That And much, I think much depends on the quality of the, actually, the most important thing is the quality of the observer, the attitude you bring towards it, the actual act of observing. And I guess another thing I could say, in a way, Shane, now I know you go through, you like to gain a lot of experience with older equipment. And in a way, by using, say, a Zeiss telescope that's 100 years old, or a Japanese orthoscopic lens from the 70s, in a way, you're doing a version of this sort of experimental archaeology of astronomy, using an old technology just to see what you can see. And there, and I think Clark made the main, Clark put out the real main reward, and that you don't know until you try it. And the act of doing, of trying these things, things will become suddenly obvious that you wouldn't have known just from reading a paper description. So, and I'm sure that's happened to you using old equipment. And you've probably been surprised at how good some of the stuff is, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it often, I remember an old Tasco telescope from the 60s, a 60 millimeter aperture with a 1,000 millimeter focal length. And, you know, I had already, you know, I had my own prejudices against these small telescopes. And one night I decided to look at Mars, and I don't know why, because in my mind, it was already made up that the view would be terrible and that I wouldn't be able to see very much. But the blue, the view blew my mind. I was able to see so much detail. And that really opened my eyes, you know, kind of pun intended, I guess, as to the capability of some of these older instruments, but also to not let aperture form my judgments, you know, that, you know, there's a lot of capability in any telescope. It's just a matter of using it.
You had to get that joke in.
Always.
Well, I think that was a really great conversation, everybody. Unfortunately, I think we're at about time. I know we covered about a third of the topics that we had laid out. So it'd be great to kind of come back and maybe do one of these in a few months' time. Really appreciate you and you, Randall, and Clark on the show today to talk to us about recreating astronomical observations using, authentic, era equipment. And I think that's something that many of us have thought about. And I certainly think about it quite a bit. But then to kind of take it and then to actually apply it. I think there's some interesting there. So without further ado, though, I'm going to end the podcast and just say once again, thank you, and thanks to all our listeners for listening.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you are interested in more information, would like to contact us, or if you would like to support the podcast, check out our website, actualastronomy.com.